The following is from Derek Jensen's book, Listening to the Land, Conversations about Nature, Culture, and Eros. It's a whole bunch of interviews, conversations that he had. This one, the first one, is from William Catton, William R. Catton Jr. The Earth cannot permanently support the current human population. It follows that someday there will be fewer humans than there are now. How the population will decrease is an open question. William R. Catton Jr. begins his book Overshoot, The Ecological Basis of Revolutionary Change, with the statement, quote, "In a future that is as unavoidable as it will be unwelcome, survival and sanity may depend upon our ability to cherish rather than to disparage the concept of human dignity. My purpose in writing this book has been to enhance that ability by providing a clear understanding of the ecological context of evolution of human life." Editor's note, I consider William Catton's book Overshoot to be one of the most, if not the most, important book I've ever read in my life. Quite possibly the most important. William Catton Jr. has taught at Reed College, University of North Carolina, University of Washington, University of Canterbury in New Zealand, and Washington State University. He won the Pacific Sociological Association's 1985 Distinguished Scholarship Award for articles in its journal expanding on themes from Overshoot. Vine Deloria called Overshoot, quote, "one of the most important books I've read in my lifetime." And Dave Foreman called it the most important book published in the last 40 years. And Michael Dowd says it's one of the most important he's ever read. And his wife, Connie Barlow, agrees. Editor's note, Catton died in January of 2015. William Catton. Anthropogenic ecosystem breakdown is the specter haunting the world today. We have to learn to recognize the effects of ecosystem overload. Our cities are running out of disposal sites for wastes. More and more, our need to draw potable water from rivers and aquifers is in conflict with the disposal of the effluents and other end products of our industrial mode of life. We need to recognize that the rising levels of greenhouse gases, the widening hole in the ozone, the drawdown of aquifers, the depletion of mineral deposits and fossil fuel stocks, the deforestation of vast land areas, the loss of topsoil, the spreading of deserts, and the accelerating decline of species diversity around the world are all signs that we are seriously overloading the planet. Every environment can support only a certain level of load placed upon it by its inhabitants. The load consists of the resources the inhabitants consume, as well as the wastes they expel. When the load exceeds what the environment can tolerate, the environment begins to break down. The environmental tolerance is called carrying capacity. Technically, an environment's carrying capacity for a given kind of creature is the number of individuals living in a given manner which that environment can support indefinitely. Indefinitely is the key word because it means that the carrying capacity is not an impenetrable ceiling. There is an important difference between the maximum load that can be imposed briefly versus the load that can be supported indefinitely. Unless the other components of that ecosystem can continually supply us, or whatever creature we're talking about, with what we need to live, and unless the ecosystem can absorb and recycle our wastes, the system will begin to break down to our own ultimate detriment. This is exactly what we're seeing in the world today. The natural consequences to carrying capacity overload is population crash. Perhaps the clearest example of this process is the introduction of yeast cells into a wine vat. The yeast find their habitat abundantly endowed with moist, sugar-laden fruit mash, exactly the resource they need for explosive population growth. As their population increases, though, the accumulation of their own fermentation products makes life increasingly difficult, until eventually the microscopic inhabitants of this artificial ecosystem die in their own waste. The cause of their death is self-inflicted pollution, the fermentation products. Another example that I cite in Overshoot is the beginning of the 29-year reindeer to St. Matthew's Island in the Bering Sea in the 1940s. By 1963, the herd had increased to 6,000 on an island with a carrying capacity for about 2,000 reindeer. Since overshoot leads to habitat damage, it is in essence stealing from one's own posterity. The crash brought the population far below what it could have previously sustained. By 1966, there were just 42 reindeer left on the island. Not all of the mortality in a crash is due to actual starvation. This is very important. During a die-off of introduced Sika deer on James Island in Maryland, the deer were well-nourished and parasite-free at the time of die-off. Their growth, however, had been inhibited by psychological disturbances caused by behavioral stress associated with high population density. Overshoot and die-off happened to people as well. After overshooting Easter Island's capacity to support human beings, the Polynesian inhabitants began their own crash by commencing genocidal conflict between two factions, the Long Ears and the Short Ears, followed by malicious disruption of food production that caused many survivors of the battles to starve. Derek Jensen. How serious is our current predicament? Catton. I feel less certain now than I did 20 years ago that outright extinction of the human species is an imminent prospect. We are, however, beginning to see the processes of crash. So far, the places in which that is resulting in increased death rates are more than offset by the natural increase going on in other parts of the world. It will be some time before enhanced world death rates exceed worldwide birth rates and global population begins to decline. But I think we will see the cessation of growth in a lot less time than many demographers are predicting. They still make projections that extend for a couple of more doublings. I don't think we'll actually have even one more doubling. Life will become sufficiently disorganized before then. The estimated population of the planet is now, as of this writing, 5.5 billion. It's now up to 7 billion as of 2016. It's actually approaching 7.5 billion. I doubt we're going to reach 10 billion. I even doubt we'll reach 8 billion. And I'm somewhat skeptical that we will reach 7. Well, he was wrong on that one. Look around today. The violence happening in the Middle East. Let's see. Hang on a second. I just want to see what the date of this book. It's published 1995. Okay, so this is 20 years old from this reading, 21 years. Look around today. The violence happening in the Middle East, in Central America, in the former Yugoslavia, the fact that these human societies are coming apart and that various ethnically distinct categories of populations are having at each other is the sort of thing that seems to be expectable when you talk about overshoot and crash. Jensen, why? Why is that? Catton, increased population pressure intensifies competition. And the greater the competitive pressure, the greater the tendency for each person to see his or her neighbor as a threat to his or her access to resources. In an age of overpopulation, each person is as much danger as being considered superfluous as the next. We each want to be reassured that it is the other person who is redundant. Thus, we vilify our competitors, portraying our enemies, quote-unquote, as so malevolent that preemptive aggression is acceptable. Unfortunately, we're not seeing very many people interpret this violence ecologically. We're still seeing it interpreted almost entirely politically and economically and religiously. People compare what is being done, called ethnic cleansing, to the Nazi Holocaust. The comparison is realistic, but you can't fully understand it unless you see it as another instance where surplus people want to declare others, not themselves, to be the surplus. The truth is, we're far beyond an age of exuberance, and the expectations that the future should be brighter than the past have broken down. That makes it possible for people to be receptive to the idea that it's because of those guys. The Serbs think it's the Bosnian Muslims are the cause of their woes, and Bosnian Muslims think it's the Serbs. But all 5.5 billion of us are the cause of woes for all of us. That's too many, and it's especially too many if we want to live by the ravenous methods modern technology has accustomed us to. Derek Jensen, you said that we're far beyond an age of exuberance. Say more. Catton. An age of exuberance is a period in which there is so much caring capacity surplus that the natural response is to expand exuberantly. When Europeans encountered America, they thought of it as the land of opportunity. And they were right. It was the land of opportunity. Here was a continent being used as habitat for hunting and gathering peoples, with some also practicing forms of horticulture. To Europeans, it seemed like an empty continent. There were millions of people here, but they didn't count because they weren't using it the way that Europeans were familiar with. The resource base was available for a much more lavish style of exploitation. So to the Europeans, it was the land of opportunity, meaning there was an opportunity for them to indulge in the intensive rate of increase of our species, to double their numbers every generation. For a while, they were not only doubling by natural increase, but by migration from Europe, which took some population pressure off that region. And then the people started shipping goods from America to Europe, which further took the pressure off back there. So Europe experienced a great exuberance too, even though it had been, as of the New World's discovery in 1492, essentially a filled-up continent. Because of the growth of human numbers and technological progress, we have since ceased to have a surplus of carrying capacity. Now America is more densely populated than Europe was then, and we're in an age where exuberant expansion just isn't the order of the day. Derek Jensen. But doesn't technology increase carrying capacity? There are certainly more people living now than before. Catton. There's a difference between a temporary load that one can be and one that can be sustained indefinitely. At present, technology has the effect of increasing per capita resource and energy consumption. But life has always depended on the existence of an outside, a place from which we can obtain resources and to which we can expel our wastes. And human reproductive and technological success, quote-unquote, has put a large proportion of the planet within our human technological system. When we learn to see the air intakes and exhaust pipes of our millions of internal combustion engines as the nostrils of what I call Homo Colossus, and realize how much more oxygen per capita we require than our ancestors consumed, and how much more we can now contaminate our surroundings by our normal activities than they could by theirs, it becomes evident that these mechanical servants have become our ecological competitors. We and our engines breathe and transform the same air and compete for the same space, the same water, and so on. Technology, then, while originally a means of increasing human carrying capacity per acre, has become a means of increasing the space, energy, and material required per human occupant. To put some numbers to that, primitive hunter-gatherers used 2,500 to 3,000 kilocalories per day, whereas modern Americans use about 200,000 kilocalories per day. Derek Jensen. Why isn't this on the front page of every paper every day? Catton. Cultural lag. Different parts of a culture change at different speeds. Sometimes tensions arise when two previously synchronous parts of a culture get out of adjustment. One part changes and another doesn't. Some people still consider the world a cornucopia. With the European settlement of the Americas, all of Western civilization experienced about four centuries of exuberant growth, and we haven't yet gotten over the idea that that's the natural order of things. The cultural lag becomes apparent when our political leaders still talk as if we can and should stimulate economic growth further. Responses based on the idea that the country needs growth lag way behind actual conditions confronting the country and the world. And so we still proliferate and keep on inventing more ways to use more resources per capita. This has the effect of digging ourselves in deeper and deeper. Derek Jensen. Where does petroleum fit into this? William Catton. Ever since we began burning fossil fuels, we have been supplementing human carrying capacity by using some of the solar energy that was captured by plants during the Carboniferous period and stored underground millions of years ago. Since this energy is prehistoric, it is not renewable in human terms. The use of it results in a temporary augmentation of carrying capacity. I call it phantom carrying capacity. It won't last. This temporary extension is significant in size. More than 9/10 of the energy used by Homo sapiens is now derived from sources other than each year's crop of vegetation. To live sustainably with current population and per capita energy consumption, modern man would require an increase in carrying capacity equivalent to 10 Earths, each of whose surfaces was used to the extent that we are currently overusing this one. Our reliance on petroleum really took hold in the 1920s. Starting then, we began doubling our use of petroleum every decade. And although we've slightly reduced our rate of increase in the past 20 years, our use is still increasing. Obviously, this increase can't go on forever. Even if the entire planet were petroleum, in about 300 years, we would have burned up the whole planet with that sort of doubling of consumption each decade. Nowhere near the entire planet is petroleum, so that 300-year estimate is absurdly optimistic. All of this, of course, raises the question, what's going to happen when we no longer have prehistoric energy to subsidize our population and patterns of consumption? Derek Jensen. I've read that by 2005 or 2010, it will take more energy to find new reserves of oil in the United States than the reserves themselves will produce. Catton. By that point, we will have effectively used it up. There might be billions and billions of barrels of petroleum inside the planet still, but if drilling and pumping use more energy than the energy content of the petroleum, there's really no point. Jensen, does this speed up the crash you envision? Catton, it would, except that economists favor a ploy called resource substitution. Just as we stopped using so much coal when we shifted to oil, there already is a shift underway to the use of more natural gas. But that, again, is a finite resource. The more conversions we can do to natural gas, the more we postpone the day of reckoning. That's all we do, though, is postpone it. We don't escape it. In the meantime, we continue to pump carbon dioxide into the atmosphere when we burn any fossil fuels. So even if there is still plenty of fuel available, that will produce a day of reckoning, when the level of the oceans starts to rise as a result of global warming. There's just no escaping the fact that we are now changing the planet in ways that are adverse to the future of our species, ways we need to be taking into account. Derek Jensen, what about nuclear power, hydroelectric? What about massive solar? Won't those keep our age of exuberance alive just a little bit longer? How about going back to coal? Catton, we could go back to coal, but that would just increase the pollution problem, which is already very severe in many localities. I think there will be more use of solar energy in the decades ahead. That will help somewhat. But I don't think the exuberant way in which we have been increasing our per capita use of energy for the last several lifetimes can be projected much into the future just by those technologies. Nuclear energy seemed like it promised that after World War II. Some of us immediately began envisioning owning a nuclear-powered automobile. That's been the American habit, to have an excessively optimistic projection of technological progress. But in the past few decades, we've been shutting down nuclear power plants. It's been more than a decade since the last one was opened, and it's been 2 decades since the last authorization to start building one was either sought or obtained. With Chernobyl, I think the Europeans are looking askance at nuclear power now, too. There was a little flurry of hope when those people in Utah claimed they had achieved cold fusion. That turned out to be at least a false alarm. And I think the prospects of actually generating usable energy from high-temperature fusion are getting dimmer and dimmer. It's useful as a bomb, but it's not useful for turning on the lights. So I think we're approaching the point where the per capita availability of energy is going to level off and possibly begin to decline from the depletion of fossil fuels. One of the problems we've created for ourselves is that all of the machinery driven by fossil fuels has made it possible to harvest timber faster than ever and made it possible to increase agricultural yields per acre and per man hour of farm labor. The upshot of all this is that we've gotten into the habit of using even renewable resources in non-renewable ways. the lush wheat fields of the Palouse, with their yields of 100 bushels per acre, are dependent not just on the local soil, but on the anhydrous ammonia farmers pump into the soil, anhydrous ammonia which is based on the use of natural gas as a feedstock. So we are in essence farming non-renewable resources, not to mention the several tons of topsoil lost to erosion for each ton of harvested grain. Our population is also dependent upon petroleum-based transportation. By joining together different areas through trade, the composite carrying capacity can exceed the sum of the carrying capacities of the separate regions. This happens because people living where carrying capacity is limited by a shortage of one essential resource can trade with the residents of another region and have an abundance of that resource while being limited by a different scarce one. Another way of interpreting this, though, is that if the populations of the regions have expanded to fill the composite carrying capacity, and then either the transportation system breaks down or the political atmosphere changes so you don't have the exchange going on, you've got an excess population load and people will feel it. Jensen. So are NAFTA and GATT then attempts to extend the age of exuberance? Catton. Precisely. But you never see the media pundits defining them as that way. Jensen. A moment ago, you mentioned the reliance of farmers on fossil fuels for their yields. That reminds me of something you've written about farming. You said that farms stop the natural process of succession. Catton. A farm, or even a garden, is a contrived ecosystem. It requires continuous attention to keep it in its desired state. Efforts must be directed toward compensating for the soil changes caused by the occupants and toward preventing the invasion of unwanted plants or weeds. Thus, a farm is an engineered effort to stop nature's process of succession. If you abandon a farm, succession takes over, and a couple of centuries later, it becomes something very different from a farm, perhaps a woodland. The conversion of forests to tree farms is an example of the same kind of effort. Second growth forests are noticeably different from climax forests. In order to support even a lesser human load than we've got now, there's no doubt we will have to hold back succession in some places. But we can't try to convert the whole world into one big farm, much less one big city. Still, so much social history in the last couple of centuries since the Industrial Revolution has seemed to attempt to convert the world into a contrived kind of ecosystem that a farm, a garden, a city constitutes, with the failure to recognize that the city is utterly dependent on the hinterland. Imagining that the destiny of rural places is in due time to become urban has really been heading us for trouble. We've defined progress as anti-succession, and that simply can't go on forever. Derek Jensen. And by the same token, aren't attempts to extend the age of exuberance also anti-successional? You've written that it's almost impossible for the ecological dominance of any species to be permanent. Catton. Yes, except in climax communities where things have come into such balance that the environmental impacts of the several member species are mutually offsetting. Or you might say dominance is less specific to one species and is more shared in a climax community. In most other circumstances, dominance tends to be ultimately self-destructive. In the case of modern human beings, human dominance is flagrantly self-destructive. Derek Jensen. Thomas Berry has written that a species is well adapted to its community if both it and the community benefit from its presence. Catton. Our aggravation of the rate of extinction of other species is a manifestation of our dysfunctional dominance. Since some of those species have turned out to be necessary for serving some of our special purposes, the harmfulness to ourselves has become evident. Derek Jensen, how did writing Overshoot change you? Catton, most of my publication since this book came out has been on topics pertaining to Overshoot. Increasingly, I've been trying to get my fellow sociologists to see that sociology needs to become an ecological discipline. We need to stop thinking of human ecology as simply a small speciality within sociology. Sociology is instead a small speciality within general ecology. A few of my colleagues have caught on to that, but not many. And since writing the book, I became convinced that we're not really facing imminent extinction of the human species, or even its northern hemisphere branch. Some fraction of it, I am now inclined to think, will survive. When I was writing Overshoot, we still had a few years of the Cold War ahead of us, but gradually it began to feel as if we were over that hump. I continue to be an optimist, even though, facing reality, I don't think you can be too confident about the future of the human species. Let me add that one of the tragedies of our time is that when we needed to be taken this kind of analysis of our situation to heart, for the whole 12 years Reagan and Bush were in office, we wasted our time instead of coming to grips with the real situation of humankind. Actually, it would have been nice if we had begun to face this at least a century ago. If a century ago we'd caught on to the fact that we have to cut off population growth, we could have leveled it off by now at a lower level than our present population, and things would have been a lot brighter. Still, I guess it's better late than never, except if you're too late, then it is tantamount to never. Jensen. You've written that in a post-exuberant age, it is important to ask, what must we avoid doing to keep from making a bad situation worse? Catton. There are proposed solutions that may do more harm than good. I commented earlier that the present administration still wants to get America moving again, still wants to increase the GNP, and so on. That's going to do harm. It's a little like getting your car stuck in a muddy place. The temptation is to bear down on the accelerator. Often, all you accomplish by spinning your wheels is to dig yourself in deeper. A lot of the proposed solutions to some of the aspects of our global ecological problem are like wheels spinning, digging in deeper. The perceptive driver doesn't do that. He or she tries to rock the thing by intermittent little surges of power. So the more knowledgeable we are about how ecosystems really work, the more likely we are to avoid digging ourselves in deeper, and the more likely we are to find something at least mildly beneficial to do. We have to remember that being human doesn't exempt us from ecological principles. We are not just involved in humanity, but in ecosystems, in associations of many species of organisms. We need to remember that what we do to an ecosystem, we do to ourselves.